Okay, good morning. Morning. I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to you all to the workshop today on sexual violence against women, asylum, voice and testimony here at University Paris 8. The workshop is the first of the three workshops attached to the project Feminist Representations, Sexual Violence Against Women, Asylum and Testimony. Funded by the British Academy, Leverhulme Trust, the project aims to explore the contributions the arts and humanities may make to address institutional failures in the area of sexual violence against women and girls, with a specific focus on asylum, translation, voice, and testimony. The three interdisciplinary workshops will bring together academics, practitioners, politicians, campaigners, and writers. The objective is to open up avenues of expression for women when relaying their testimonies and the impact of sexual violence, and to provide feminist representation that moves beyond the parameters of legal expression. Adopting an interdisciplinary methodology, participants will examine case studies of asylum seekers' testimonies as a means to reveal the issues of translation women meet when voicing their narratives. The project will shed light on specific issues women seeking asylum who have experienced sexual violence encounter when telling their stories. These findings will inform academics, policymakers, and writers who will address these issues in scholarly and creative works. Within the context of asylum claims, the question of interpretation and oral testimony is a critical issue. Deborah Singer, MBE, Policy Manner and Research Manner of Asylum Aid, in her recent work on the protection gap, points to issues of translation that affect women's testimonies, such as words changing meaning within different cultural contexts, the way in which women's voices are muted through translation, and the lack of provisions available in terms of understanding the narratives of women seeking asylum. Deborah Singer and Rahab Jamil will be talking about the Protection Gap campaign in their presentation later this morning. In the field of the legal humanities, feminist scholars have taken up the question of voicing women's narratives of sexual violence. Research on storytelling, performance and narrative, for instance, Catherine Abrams' 2007 study, The Paths of Stories, and Elizabeth Schneider's and Stephanie Wildman's 2010 collection, Women and the Law Stories, have, in Abrams' words, recognised the richness of narrative and its contributions to legal analysis. Rosemary Hunter, Claire McGinn, and Erica Radley's work, published in 2010, Feminist Judgments from Theory to Practice, addresses the use of alternate expression in legal contexts. Mairead Enright and Julie McCandless, in their recent collection Northern Irish Feminist Judgments, published in 2017, incorporate the fields of art and literature in their feminist judging methodology, alongside engaging with legal and non-legal expertise and experience. From James Boyd's White 1973 study, The Legal Imagination, to recent studies such as Peter Brook's Narrative Transactions, Does a Law Need a Narratology? Scholars and practitioners have sought to produce a theoretical body of work on law as narrative, literature and rhetoric that examines the language of the law and the limits of legal language. The proposed project extends these concerns to the under-examined area of sexual violence and testimony in asylum claims. The objective of the project is to uncover the problems women experience when relaying their testimony and the impact of sexual violence. The project provides a forum for experts in a variety of fields proximate to asylum to arrive at solutions or aids to solving the problems inherent in gathering testimony from traumatized migrants and refugees. Writing is able to express and represent narrative fracture, mistranslation, silence, repetition, and hybrid languages. The representative power of writing and performance is evident in the recent work of Carolyn Bergvall, whose multimedia experimental work Drift mixes language, human rights reports of contemporary sea migrants' disasters with Anglo-Saxon and ancient Nordic seafaring literature and uses performance and multimedia installations to produce texts that are movable and abstract, a shifting, sounding language mass. Bergvall's recent work, Rag o' Dawn, a site-specific work performed at dawn in the UK and the EU, addresses the linguistic territories of the UK and Europe, endangered languages, and languages emerging from recent settlement. Another very important contemporary project, The Refugee Tales, led by David Hurd, brings writers together with refugees to narrate their migrant experiences. The multiple forms of the works reveal the importance of various forms of writing and language to the expression of human experience and the formation of new modes of literary activisms. We will be hearing more about this work this afternoon from Dr. Lucy Williams, who worked on the Refugees Tales project. In 2017, a collection of refugee narratives titled Voices from the Jungle, Stories from the Refugee Camp was published. The important collection, Voiced Narratives and Creative Writing by Africa, Ali Hagui, Ali Baja, Babak Inalu, Eritrea, Habibi, Harris Haider, Majods, Mani, Mixeya, Muhammad Ahmed, Muhammad, Omar, aka Dream, Riaz Ahmed, Safia, Shaheen Ahmed Vali, Shikeb, Teddy, Teza, Zishan Imiet, and Zishan Javid. Such projects and collections reveal a growing body of works that seek to empower and amplify the voices of those who have experienced and are experiencing forced migration. Feminist Representations builds on such work by bringing lawyers, practitioners, policymakers, scholars, writers, artists, and leading figures from public-facing bodies in Europe to exchange knowledge and bring to light the key issues surrounding sexual violence, voice, translation, and testimony. The findings will then be used to situate the issues in a legal humanities context and to explore the way in which the arts and humanities might empower voice and enact change in the area of sexual violence against women and girls and asylum. The focus of the project is not to theorise or to abstract the issues at hand, but to work towards active, positive change. In this way, the project is very much a platform for feminist activisms and for thinking through and creating forms of feminist solidarity. In its conception, the feminist commitment of the project is very much in line with the work of Chandra Talpaid Mahanti in her brilliant work of transnational feminism titled Feminism Across Borders. Mahanti states, borders suggest both containment and safety, and women often pay a price for daring to claim the integrity, security, and safety of our bodies and our living spaces. Mahanti writes that she chooses the term feminism without borders to stress that our most expansive and inclusive versions of feminism need to be attentive to borders while learning to transcend them. It is important, Mahanti stresses, to acknowledge that feminism without borders is not the same as borderless feminism. By contrast to a borderless feminism, feminism without borders acknowledges that fault lines, conflicts, differences, fears, and containment that borders represent. It acknowledges that there is no one sense of a border, that the lines between and through nations, races, classes, sexualities, religions, and disabilities are real, and that a feminism without borders must envisage change and social justice work across these lines of demarcation and division. Mahanti's transnational feminism, then, is a feminism without silences and exclusions, one that, in her words, draws attention to the tension between simultaneous plurality and narrowness of borders and the emancipatory potential of crossing through, with, and over these borders in our everyday lives. Feminist Representations takes Mahanti's idea of feminism without borders, of pluralism and a feminist solidarity, as a starting point and a foundation for the feminist thought that might emerge from the project. The objective of the first international workshop today is to examine the restrictions imposed upon women's voices in the context of reporting sexual violence as part of their migration experience in Europe. Professor Rashida Manju, former UN Special Rapporteur for Violence Against Women, will address the gender injustice dimensions of the asylum process in her keynote paper. Our speakers include Deborah Singer, MBE, Senior Policy Advisor at Asylum Aid, Rihad Jamil, Protection Gap Advocate and member of Asylum Aid's Women's Advisory Committee, and Professor Jane Friedman here at the University Paris 8. The workshop will bring together academics from Europe and representatives from public-facing bodies, NGOs and women refugees and asylum seekers. It will facilitate a cross-sector and interdisciplinary exchange of knowledge and experience in relation to taking testimonies and translation. Women's testimonies will be considered with regard to language, translation, and testimony. These issues will be examined alongside the current procedure of seeking asylum, in particular the interview process. As you will see from today's programme, Professor Rashida Manju will open the workshop with her keynote paper in a moment, Gender and Justice Dimensions of the Asylum Process. Rashida will then take questions and we'll have a short break before our second keynote presentation by Deborah Singer and Rihad Jamil. Deborah and Rihad will be presenting on their recent work for Asylum Aid, in particular the Protection Gap campaign. We'll then break for lunch and reconvene after lunch for the roundtable on asylum, voice and testimony, chaired by Professor Jane Friedman and myself. After our afternoon panellists are Violaine Hasson from La Simard, Aniko Bekonyi from the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, Dr. Lucy Williams from the University of Kent, Anne-Cécile Sesseau and Sebastiano Cesaro from the Gender, Sexuality and Migration Group here at University Paris 8. This project is very much a platform for knowledge exchange, and we hope that it's going to function in that way today. So we're going to conclude the day with a knowledge exchange drinks reception. So any questions that you have wanted to ask during the day to our speakers, you will then be able to ask them personally at the knowledge exchange drinks. So the project website can be found at feministrepresentations.com. Yeah, that would be great. Here we go. And there's lots of resources here as well. So it's designed for researchers, it's designed for knowledge exchange. Great, if you're doing a PhD in the area, we've got information on the workshops, project partners, but really importantly, links to resources and papers, which I'm going to be updating with a report on the day, but also the speakers' papers. So there's going to be lots and lots of information there if you can't quite write it all down during the keynotes. And then we are on Twitter today as well. So that's on the slide again, sorry. Oh, no, it's fine. And we're tweeting at Feminist Representations. So if you do tweet and you would like to tweet, there's lots of people in the UK who want to follow us on Twitter. So if you'd like to tweet at all, then please do that with the hashtag Feminist Representations. The proceedings today are fully translated and interpreted by a really brilliant team led by Philippe and Poonam at the back. So hi, thank you, Philippe Poonam. A really big thank you for making the interpretation possible. There are headsets over here. Has Philippe said?
I think everyone understood.
Everyone understands how to use the headsets, yeah. So do grab one if you'd like to use them. And finally, I'd like to thank Professor Jane Friedman and University Paris 8 for collaborating and supporting this international workshop. So to begin, it is a great honour to introduce our keynote speaker for today, Professor Rashida Manju. Rashida Manju is a professor and convener of the Human Rights Programme in the Department of Public Law, University of Cape Town, South Africa. She is also a visiting professor at Queen Mary University of London. Until July 2015, Professor Manju held the position of United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, Its Causes and Consequences, a post she was appointed to in 2009 by the UN Human Rights Council. Her UN work over 6 years has included monitoring and reporting on states' compliance in responding to and preventing violence against women, its causes and consequences, both generally and in different country contexts. Her research and teaching has focused on the intersectional nature of discrimination, including on the basis of sex, gender, race, class, location, disability, socioeconomic conditions, and historical and cultural contexts. She has particularly highlighted the interaction of interpersonal, communal, institutional, and structural factors that negatively impact the interdependence and indivisibility of the human rights of women. Professor Manju is a former parliamentary commissioner of the Commission on Gender Equality, an institution created by the Constitution of South Africa with a mandate to oversee the promotion and protection of gender equality and women's rights. She has also been involved in social context training for judges and lawyers, where she has designed both content and methodology. Professor Manju has over 4 decades of experience in social justice and human rights work, both in South Africa and abroad. Her research interests include human rights broadly, with a particular focus on women's human rights. She has authored a number of journal articles, book chapters, and reports on women's human rights, violence against women, transnational justice, and state responsibility to act with due diligence in the quest to promote and protect the human rights of women. Her book publications include Women's Charters and Declarations, Building Another World, Due Diligence in Addressing Violence Against Women in Sub-Saharan Africa, and the recent co-edited book, The Legal Protection of Women from Violence, Normative Gaps in International Law. So please welcome Professor Rashida Manju.
Thank you very much to all of you for being here, and I'm going to try not to theorize too much, but I do think that, well, first of all, thank you to the organizers, the sponsors, and particularly Georgina and Jane for including me as part of the International Advisory Committee in this project. I come as a lawyer, but I consider myself an activist lawyer. So it's not just about legal frameworks and policy frameworks, but also about access to justice and to justice itself for women, whatever the context of women's lives are. And reflecting on this project and how we bring violence against women and asylum together has been challenging because I don't come from the arts and the humanities. I come from law. But that doesn't mean that I can't extrapolate experiences, particularly having heard so many voices, so much a testimony, and then having to sanitize it for UN reports in a way that I think loses the value, the voices, etc., because there's a certain format that one follows even in an investigation of a country. Not because as independent experts in the system, we are afraid of repercussions because we don't work for the UN. They don't pay us to do the kind of work we do. But there is that diplomatic angle that you don't want to piss off member states. So there's a way of framing that is different, that is underpinned by the human rights norms, the treaties, the obligations that states undertake and giving the message. But I think the first-hand kind of testimonies that you hear while you're investigating a country, that doesn't come out in the kind of reports that we present on our country missions. The voices become important when we write, because we do 2 different kinds of reports, and we do thematic reports. And the thematic reports would be on themes ranging from violence against women with disabilities. And that's where the voices become important in terms of thinking through how do we push the conceptual understandings of member states, on these issues, as opposed to member states thinking violence against women equates domestic violence, full stop. And so, you know, it doesn't get lost, but it is a source of frustration that one does sanitize and put out a report that loses, I think, the kind of work that many of you in the room do. So I'm very, very interested in learning from the experts who do the voice, the testimony in the asylum process, what are the challenges, etc. But I did think that it is important for me to highlight the institutional and the structural aspects that I see as contributing to the barriers and challenges and gaps that women experience in the asylum process. So thank you, Jane. So the context, and I think, you know, the statistics are not disputed. The World Health Organization calls violence against women an epidemic. If this was a medical epidemic, there'd be a state of emergency declared globally. But it isn't, because it's violence against women. And I'm talking in the broadest possible range of violence against women in terms of forms, the manifestations, etc. So 1 in 3 is the statistic globally, World Health Organization, UN Women, and other agencies. Whether that violence is in public spaces or in the private sphere, whether it's in times of peace, conflict, post-conflict, displacement, etc. And as people who work in the violence sector, in the asylum sector, you know that violence functions on a continuum. It's not as if we can neatly separate the private and the public spheres. It's a continuum. The kind of oppression, discrimination, violence that women experience in the private sphere, we see an exacerbation of that in the conflict area. And so trying to separate that sexual violence in conflict is exceptional. It's different. It isn't. It's a continuum of women's realities that are exacerbated in times of conflict. And that's something that I have constantly stressed to member states, that this privileging of sexual violence in conflict is coming at a cost of addressing the low-level warfare that women face on an everyday basis in the private sphere, in their national settings, etc. The challenge has always been that rather than accountability being the norm, impunity is the norm, where member states are failing. And they're failing not because they do not have the legal and policy frameworks. Often, there is a very good legal and policy frameworks. It's the practices, it's the implementation gaps, it's the enforcement gap, and it's also the lack of accountability. So not holding state authorities accountable for failing to protect and prevent against harm. So impunity is at many levels, including the direct perpetrators, but also at the level of the state. In terms of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the last statistics that I saw was 22.5 million people in the world are refugees. 55%, it's a high number, fleeing from 3 countries, South Sudan, Syria, Afghanistan. Only 17% of the displaced persons are hosted in Europe. So, you know, this question is, where are the rest going? What sort of dangerous missions are they taking to get to a safe space away from these contexts? And I would love to hear if there are gender disaggregated data for Europe in terms of the 17%. How many are women? How many are women subjected to sexual violence, both in the private and the public spheres? The literature tells us very clearly women's challenge, women's experiences in asylum seeking is different from those of men, the institutional and structural aspects, the gender bias, discrimination in the status determination process. We can't pretend that the person whose job it is to determine status does not hold certain views, whether it's patriarchal views, whether it's misogynist views, whether it's views about certain racial groups or religious groups, the political context from within they come. So there are those. I mean, when I used to do the training of judges, you know, judges think once you put on the cloak, it's a magic cloak, that all your prejudices, your biases, your stereotypes about the person in front of you magically disappear because now you put on the magic cloak. It isn't. No matter what we do, even in our teaching, or as students. We do hold certain views, and it's about where we come from, the positions that we hold, our place in society, how we're viewed. And so the gender bias and discrimination is part and parcel of us examining the service providers within the state sector who do the status determination. I think we are in an important year this year. The Universal Declaration is 70 years old this year in December. I'm sure there'll be many countries celebrating the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And it is, I mean, it's always an appropriate time to reflect on women's rights to a life, women and girls. When I talk about women, I'm including girls, to a life free of all forms of violence, but also the right to asylum. I sometimes think these celebrations are short-sighted because we should rather be reflecting on the shortcomings in the international human rights humanitarian system. But I think that we also should celebrate that we have a document that has stood the test of time for 70 years and figure out where to now and how do we strengthen this. And whether it's the violence sphere, whether it's the asylum sphere, there are certain core norms and values that are embedded, whether it starts with the 1945 UN Charter, the UDHR in 1949, and subsequent treaties, nine other treaties that have been adopted: dignity, equality, non-discrimination, justice, freedom, peace. These are core values, right? These are core values that underpin the work that, you know, whatever work we do, in whether it's asylum, whether it's violence, whatever. And I think sometimes we forget the core values and forget that they're embedded in international law. And once a country signs and ratifies, there are obligations that arise. And I have found in many contexts, you know, women would talk about harm that they've experienced, the failure of the state, but they will not draw on that language of state obligations, state responsibilities, because that's the language at the UN that the states understand. When you put it into a report, you say you have failed, woman, because you are in violation of your treaty obligations. And I think the more we reinforce this, it's not about the rhetoric of rights, because there is, you know, a kind of backlash against human rights discourse, human rights norms and standards, but it is about reinforcing, for me, state obligations, state responsibilities, reminding the state that you have this obligation because you voluntarily undertook to sign and ratify international law. Article 2 in the UDHR is important. It's about the rights and freedoms without distinction, that the non-discrimination aspect, race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, etc. And that norm of non-discrimination in the asylum process would be applicable to the country of origin, where the person's coming from, but also the country of refuge that she's seeking. Because I'm sure except South Sudan, which hasn't signed and ratified CEDAWs yet, and many of the international treaty, but it's a new country that was created. But the norms are applicable and the non-discrimination obligation applies. And I'm not sure how often it gets used, and I'd be very interested to hear from Deborah and Rehab on whether this is used with the country of origin and the country of refuge as well. Article 3, the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, really important, both in terms of the sexual violence and the asylum process. The right not to be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, another important norm when we think of refugee camps, we think of the process, we think of the separation of families, etc., and torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. For me, the creative use of the law would be important. The UDHR 70 years ago included the right to seek and enjoy asylum, but not the right to a guarantee of asylum. And in the drafting process, it was suggested that there should be a right, because how can you say you have a right to seek and to enjoy if there isn't a guaranteed right? But that the member states 70 years ago decided, nope, it was too much, and they weren't going to have that. So what I've tried to do, without being defeatist or negative, is highlighting some of the challenges that I see from an institutional and a structural perspective. And I'm sure there are really good stories of work that is being done, of boundaries that have been challenged, the creative use of whether it's a refugee convention or the whole treaty body system. So the normative gaps, the UN Refugee Convention, it's, you know, I think it's accepted that it's part of international human rights law, and it's not just about humanitarian or migration or immigration. But there are normative and procedural gaps. We know that. There's no explicit mention of sex or gender in the 1951 Refugee Convention. I think it probably was really hard to negotiate that. But it does beg the question, because you had the 1945 UN Charter, you had the 1948 Universal Declaration, where sex is mentioned, discrimination on the basis of sex, religion, race is mentioned. So why not include sex in the Refugee Convention of 1951, you know? And, of course, it then asks the other question, who was sitting at the table, right? Who was blocking this? And that's how international law works. My first lesson to my students is, because they come in very idealistic about the UN, and I say the UN is a government of governments, and they work in their own interests. So don't think the UN is this independent institution. It isn't. It's a government of governments, and they're going to work its whether they're developing international law or reframing it or interpreting it, it is about working in their own interest as governments. So there's no right to be granted asylum. That was rejected at the drafting stage. But the High Commissioner, High Commissioner of Refugees, has developed amazing interpretation tools to assist member states and non-member states as well, who are not party to the 1951 Convention. But interpretive tools, whether it's by the High Commissioner for Refugees or it's the treaty bodies like CEDAW, the Human Rights Committee, etc., these tools are not legally binding. They are what we call soft law. So they have a persuasive value, they have an educative value, but they do not create obligations on the state to do anything. CEDAW, which is the Women's Bill of Rights, basically, is a 1979 document. It's an anti-discrimination treaty. I mean, there are arguments that it's an equality treaty. No, it's an anti-discrimination treaty, right? And there's no explicit mention of women and asylum in that. But the norms of non-discrimination, equality, state responsibility are built into CEDAW. And they can be used to combat and eliminate discrimination, both in the country of origin and the host country, or the potential host country. What the committee did and what the committee does is it develops interpretive tools and guidelines for states through general recommendations. And the General Recommendation 32 of CEDAW, general recommendations are the same equivalent of what is called general comments that other treaty bodies develop. But it is soft law, non-binding, but guidelines to help member states to provide guidance on the, and it's the General Recommendation 32 is gender-related dimensions of refugee status, asylum, nationality, and statelessness. So things that are linked together brought into this. And, you know, my reading of it is that it largely draws on the High Commissioner for Refugees guidelines, the interpretation tools. Brought together into CEDAW to show how the norms of equality, non-discrimination, and state responsibility can be used to interpret the rights of women seeking asylum. Okay, so that's challenge one. The other challenge for me as I think about interacting with state authorities, whether it's prison authorities, refugee camps, detention centers, etc., whether it's people who do status determination, is do they recognize, if we name gender-specific persecution, gender-related persecution, do they recognize? What's the nuance there? Do they recognize this for the purposes of their decision-making? How easy or difficult is it for people, civil servants largely, to make that differentiation, to understand the context and realities that women are talking about. So for feminists, you know, it's easy when I say gender-specific persecution, we say, well, does this harm disproportionately impact women? The answer is yes, it's gender-specific. Sexual violence, including rape, FGM, etc., would fall under that. And it kind of says to me, well, that's the more overt and visible, right? Gender-related persecution, if I was sitting making a status determination, if someone alleged gender-related persecution, would I understand that as a civil servant? The causal relationship between gender and persecution. It's not due to your biological sex, but your non-compliance with gender norms, standards, expectations, whether it's based on, you know, the society you live in, the culture, the religious norms that are expected of you. As the person, the examiner making the determination, your own views on women, you know, your patriarchal views, your misogynistic views on women, talking to you about gender-related persecution, does it allow for an objective process? Or is your view colored by the fact, no, this is nonsense, there's no religion or culture that demands a certain dress code, you know, because you live in a context where you're free to walk around naked if you want, you know. How are you able to understand that different context that imposes certain norms and behaviors on women? A third challenge is the public-private dichotomy. And I mean, you know, none of these are mutually exclusive. They all kind of feed into each other. And for people who look at international law in a feminist lens, I mean, you know, the seminal kind of article that most of us turn to is the Hilary Charlesworth, Christine Chinkin article on the normative structures of international law, how they exclude, invisibilize, marginalize women's experiences and their realities. The practice of international law also is, you know, marginalizes women's experiences. For almost 70 years, we haven't been able to get a woman in as Secretary General of the UN. The practices tell you that. The hierarchy in the UN system, you know, it tells you that the practice of international law also has this kind of inbuilt. And if you've got that at the international level, how is this impacting the discourse and the thinking at the national level as well? Because that's setting an example, you know. And I think the CEDAW committee has been questioning, you know, member states. Who do you send as your ambassadors? How many women do you have in your consulates in different parts of the world? Are women all at the lower level? And these are questions that are going on in the UN as well about the hierarchy and the perpetuation of, I suppose it's discrimination when you can't recognize women's value. International law also reproduces the dichotomies between the public and the private spheres, right? For a long time, it was as if the private sphere was untouchable. We didn't look into that because that's not our business. But what went on in the private spheres, in detention centers, in prisons, torture, that we could look at. But the torture that women experienced in their homes, in their communities, no, that was hands off. And so international law has reproduced that. So if you think about the torture convention, right? The torture convention talks about torture experienced at the hands of state agents. Now, how many women who report on whether it's domestic violence, sexual violence, etc., it's at the hands. It's more at the hands of the private actors as opposed to public sphere actors. I think there are still many spaces in the world where the private sphere is considered untouchable. And in the UN, there is this discourse about traditional values. And, you know, you kind of, the red flag goes up. Traditional values, whose traditional values? Does traditional values again create this private-public dichotomy? Because will traditional values then be applicable to women back into the private sphere, you know? And these are discourses. And more recently, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights is also talking in the same sort of terms of traditional values. And I'm not sure that there is one traditional value that everyone subscribes to. The differential legal policy practice responses to violence in public and private spheres. State intervention in the private sphere, it's minimal, hands off. So even when there's a legal framework, the lack of budgets, the lack of, well, adequate funding, the lack of trained people to be able to interpret, implement, enforce laws is problematic in most states, even in the global north. The social perception of women and their stereotypical role within societies. Does this trigger interpretations that reinforce the public-private dichotomy in asylum proceedings? I mean, I don't know, you know, when I think about violence against women under international law, not many people realize that actually in international law, states do not have an obligation to protect against, prevent, and eliminate violence against women. There's nothing in CEDAW. There's nothing in any other treaty. So that's my broken record for 6 years, that we need a treaty on violence against women and girls in the UN system. A focus on civil and political rights in the asylum process. You know, if you can see the torture, if you know it's happening in camps and detention centers or in the male public sphere, is there more of a focus on that? More focus on due process rights, on justice, etc., as opposed to the torture that's experienced in the private sphere by women. How do we articulate that? So if there's more of a focus on civil and political rights, women's experiences, it's more about a deprivation of economic, social, and cultural rights, right? Deprivation or denial or violation of economic, social, cultural rights disproportionately impacts women. Is this viewed as a private female sphere? Does it lead to failure to incorporate women's experiences into the asylum claims? But within the civil and political rights as well, women's participation in politics is viewed differently, right? It's lesser than a man's participation in political activity. It's seen as low level, probably a hobby that she joined a march, you know? It's not seen as serious opposition to political regimes, etc. And there is a huge discussion around human rights defenders and reprisals and the sexualized nature of reprisals against women human rights defenders. I saw this in Sudan. I saw this in Honduras, people who work with indigenous communities as well. And women are punished on two levels here for political activities, for their political activities in the private sphere, for being seen as going... having opposition to a political regime, but also acting outside of traditional gender roles, right? So it's a two-way, it's a dual kind of persecution that happens. The focus on sex rather than gender, and you know, quite a bit of this comes from academic articles on the asylum and the critical aspects of the asylum process. So when we articulate women's experiences as different to men, we base that on sex rather than on gender. So women are opposite to men, they experience biologically. So we use the male comparator, which is highly problematic. So the discourse is not about treating people on an equal footing as human beings and to act within norms of equality, non-discrimination, dignity, etc. But you're different because of biology. And so the context and realities of women's lives, their experiences, how culture, how religion, political spaces, physical, mental, geographic location, sexual orientation, gender identity, historical oppression, where you know societies have come from, fails to be considered in a holistic way in an asylum process. I mean, it's you know, it also fails to be factored into domestic level when women come with violence against women cases. It's not that holistic approach. It is about the band-aid. What happened today? Do you have medical evidence? Have you reported it? Blah, blah. Also, when we focus on sex rather than gender, we generalize women's experiences and we act as if women are a homogenous group. They're all the same, so, you know, this is about their biology. Which does a disservice to the discourse on trans women, right? Because then we're looking at biology as opposed to a gender identity that women adopt as well. It also precludes us taking diversity and specificity into account, which is a tall order for some civil servants, but it's needed if we want to realize sort of justice in the asylum process. treating women as homogenous also, we then tend to ignore the intragender differences, right? The differences between women, their social locations, their class, their educational ability, etc. And that's important in all the work we do on women's human rights. There is a discussion about whether we should have gender, because there are 5 persecution grounds in the 1951 convention. Should we have a 6th persecution ground included of explicitly gender? The proponents would argue we need the specificity. If we've got it there, then you have to focus on it as well. Others argue that no, if we interpret the 1951 convention through a gender responsive lens or a gender sensitive lens, then women are included. And that's how the work and plus the interpretive tools of the High Commissioner for Refugees are sufficient. There's also the fear in the international law system that if we open up a treaty, you may lose, right, ground that has been hard won, hard fought by you know, a feminist, by activists, etc. So if you're going to lose ground in a climate of hostility to human rights, is it worth the battle? So there are these, you know, and I would hear the same thing in the UN when I was the special rapporteur, when I would talk about the normative gap in international law, that CEDAW as a 1979 treaty does not cater for certain things. And having these interpretive tools in the form of general recommendations is not sufficient, because it does not impose any obligations on states. And they would say, well, you know, if we open up the treaty, we're going to lose more in this climate of traditional values and backlash against women's rights, etc. But that shouldn't be a reason not to develop international law, right? Because it's not about our generation, it's about the next generation as well. What did we leave as a legacy? Did we leave sort of frameworks that are important? There's also, I don't think, any certainty that if we add a gender, and this is, you know, something for the practitioners I'd like to hear, if we add a gender as a 6th persecution ground, whether that would resolve the problem of women failing in their asylum applications. And of course, there's always the argument that if we had a gender-sensitive, gender-responsive interpretation, we can change the world. And that's the answer to the problem. There is the challenge, of course, that there isn't a focus on all persecution grounds currently in the asylum process. So there's an over-usage of the persecution ground of membership of a particular group, which is used often. The narrow focus, again, to pick up on the last point. So there are 5 persecution grounds, as many of you know, that you have to have a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and or membership of a particular social group. I put in the and or because I would think that one would look holistically at all the persecution grounds as opposed to just these little boxes, the 5 boxes, and I'm seeing someone's shaking their head, and I'm interested in hearing about that. So race-based persecution can include sexual violence, as we know. We know this from the former Yugoslavia, ethnic cleansing in Rwanda, but it's not used often by women, right, the race-based persecution. Ironically, it's being used in South Africa at the moment by our previous oppressors, by white people saying, because of, you know, new black government, white people are persecuted, and they want to go to Canada and the US and other countries seeking asylum because of race-based persecution, which is quite rich coming from them. Religious persecution can also be gender-related, as we know, where religion assigns particular roles to women, particular behaviors, particular dress codes, and persecutes them for non-compliance or violations. Also not used, in my view, from the literature, often for gendered persecutions, because we kind of take women and we, you know, the thing of add women and stir. So you put them into the membership of a particular group and finish. That's where they stay. So we don't use religious persecution as much as we could. And again, it'll be interesting to hear from practitioners how often it gets used. Political opinion, of course, it's not about being a card-carrying member of the Communist Party in your country or whatever. It's not about that. or openly articulating a political opinion, but it can be imputed, right, based on action or inaction, political opinions of family members, etc. Feminism can be a political opinion, isn't it, in certain contexts and countries? Having an opinion on gender roles and women's rights can be of a political nature, but do we creatively use that? Right? And I think the discourse on human rights defenders, whether they work on land rights, indigenous peoples, minority rights, etc., this political opinion persecution ground can be quite useful instead of sticking to the membership of a particular social group and essentializing women's, you know, biology and gender. Human rights defenders' work is political in nature. They're challenging the status quo, right? They're challenging the practices of the state. They're challenging the discrimination and inequality. And so how do we look at that? In many of the countries that I visited, human rights defenders, the persecution takes on a sexual nature. So based on their political work, their activism, etc., challenging the status quo, but can we, you know, is that understood by the civil servants who do status reviews? The membership of the particular social group, of course, is the easiest. It's viewed as the safety net and a catch-all phrase. That's the persecution ground. So sex, gender characteristics obviously, you know, contribute to it being used because it's the easiest of grounds to be used, and it's that catch-all. But is the membership of a particular social group based on sex or gender, sex and gender? But what about other social groups? I'm a member of a particular group of women in Sudan, you know. Is that a social group that's over and above the fact that I am a woman biologically or in terms of my identity? Other characteristics. Can we have a social group of victims of sexual violence in conflict, right? Affects a whole range of people. Can we have that? I think membership of a particular social group is a lazy characterization, that it's on biology, it's on gender roles, etc. And we need to think about how do we move away from that and use the others, which seem more important, right? Another challenge, a structural problem that I see in the Refugee Convention that would then govern asylum applications, is the requirements that have to be fulfilled. So the person must have a well-founded fear of persecution. The harm must be serious harm. That raises the bar pretty high. There must be no state protection from prosecution. And the well-founded fear must be by reasons of one of the five persecution grounds that I discussed. So if we take well-founded fear of persecution, there are two elements. There's an objective element, well-founded, subjective element of fear, right? The burden of proof is on the woman to show that she has a real fear of returning to her country of origin. And in her testimony, her, you know, highlighting her context, her reality, etc. And what are the challenges there? Does the person examining the case have any obligations to investigate, assess, over and beyond the kind of pro forma way that the application goes? If she has the onus, the burden of proof, who helps with this? Because you probably got someone who's traumatized, who's been in and out of the system, trying to figure out how does she bear that onus of proof, the burden on her own. If there are no NGOs, no attorneys that assist in this process, which, you know, some countries they have, others they don't. The assessment of her country of origin plays a huge role in the determination. And where's the onus there? Is it on the civil servant to make sure that they're getting sufficient information to be able to make that status determination? Do states put adequate resources into doing this kind of investigation, which is part and parcel of access to justice and to justice, right? So she gives her testimony, her version. You're trying to test that evidence that she's given. But do you, as the civil servant, have the resources to be able to get adequate information that allows you to do the balancing here? In practice, I believe in some European countries, there is the practice of giving women the benefit of the doubt. But the landscape is changing. You know, we're moving to the political right in so many countries. And so that benefit of the doubt may not necessarily be applicable in terms of women's testimonies on sexual violence. The other requirement of serious harm, right? So how do we determine serious harm? Because serious harm to me might be different to the person who's sitting comfortably in a European country, what serious harm is. And even within the human rights discourse, there isn't a common understanding of what serious harm is. It's a case-by-case approach, right? So I'm going to look at each of the cases individually. What's the test? Is there a test for serious harm? And one, I think it was Alice Edwards in one of her articles, says if the core of the right is affected and the violation infringes human dignity, that qualifies as serious harm. I'm sure if we took that to a civil servant, they'd laugh us out of the room, right? Saying, if the core of the right is affected, so my right to dignity, my right to equality, my right to bodily integrity in a sexual violence scenario, if that core is affected, and that means there is a violation of human dignity, that qualifies as serious harm. I'm not sure that a civil servant would understand it in the same way that many of us would. The state has to be unable or unwilling to protect its citizens, right? So the serious harm can be inflicted by the state or its agents. So think about the privatization of prisons and detention centers now, right? It's privatized, but that's, as far as I, you know, I'm concerned, those are agents of the state. They might be private companies. There was this argument in the US in terms of detention centers have been privatized, so the state has no responsibility. No, you incarcerated the person. The responsibility still vests with you, you know. So non-state actors inflicting serious harm, the state is unwilling to protect, or the state is unable to protect for whatever reasons, whether it's resource constraints or whether it's a patriarchal society that believes that, you know, what happens to women is not important. So I'm sure the person doing the assessment is going to ask, what is the level of state protection? And she's going to say, we have a law on sexual violence or sexual offenses. And then that's it. Oh, well, you have a law. Let's tick that box. Is the law implemented effectively? Is it interpreted adequately? Is accountability the norm? These are not questions that I can see a civil servant asking in terms of assessing what is the level of state protection or what should it be? Do we have a gold standard of what state protection should be, you know, and do we aspire to that? Or do we say, well, that's a third world country in the global south, and, you know, what can we can't expect the Council of Europe Convention standards in that as well. So in many instances, impunity is a norm in the country of origin for violence, for acts of violence against women. And, you know, I don't know how someone who's sitting in a European context assesses level of state protection and understands it, that the non-discrimination principle applies. It doesn't mean because she's in Ethiopia that the standard, we should have a different standard when we're testing her evidence. She needs to prove serious harm and also the failure in state protection. So that's kind of a dual burden that she bears, right? Because the onus is on her. And then by reasons of the other requirement, the causal link between the persecution grounds, what's the trigger? And the well-founded fear of race, political opinion, etc. If the persecution doesn't fall in these five grounds that I spoke about, example, persecution by non-state actors in the private sphere, we don't have a ground of persecution on that. So what is the argument? Where's the causal link? What's the trigger there? You know, how do we interpret that? I put the slide in, but I'm no expert on it, and I think that's where I'm looking forward to Deborah and Reha talking about the implementation gaps and things that I want to learn about. No pressure, Deborah and Reha. So in terms of information about procedure, about rights, about benefits, from what I've understood from the literature, that it's usually a brief leaflet that's handed out, and if she's a dependent, then it's given to the main applicant in the asylum process, whether the gender aspects are explained or it's left to, you know, people that work in Asylum Aid and others to provide this information. the languages that's used, is it written, is there oral, interpretation, other media to cater for diversity of where people are coming. Use of interpreters, of course, is a huge issue. When you train judges and magistrates, you know, kind of getting them to understand just because someone doesn't make eye contact doesn't mean they're shifty, right? They come from a cultural context where someone in a position of authority, you don't make, it's disrespectful to make eye contact directly with that person. And I can imagine that the same would be applicable in the asylum process as well. Guidelines, interpretation of all persecution grounds as opposed to membership of a particular social group. How do we creatively use those five? Education and training of state service providers, you know, is it specific on the refugee law, on asylum seekers? What about the general education on human rights broadly? How about contextualizing your area of work within a broader human rights, humanitarian perspective? Should it be continuous or is it just one-off and then you sit for 20 years in this position? Burnout of staff, you know, I started thinking about when you just think about the violence against women sector and the service providers. I'm sure, you know, there is burnout at the level of service providers within the state on this issue. Does the state have a responsibility to also educate and train NGOs, charity, you know, organizations? I'm sure, you know, they can do it themselves, but does the state have a responsibility since the charity NGO sector carries such a huge burden in terms of providing access, in terms of providing services? Is that a state responsibility? Credibility and evidence challenges. I think my colleagues are going to talk about the high standard of proof, the availability of corroborative evidence, impact of trauma and shame on disclosing and on the demeanor. Do women have the evidence? So she alleges sexual violence, continuous, private sphere. I was injured. I sought medical treatment. When she flees in her country of refuge, does she have the paperwork to prove that she went to the police and they did nothing? They said, go back home or whatever. Does she have the medical reports? Is there a system that she could have reported to? What about family pressure, community pressure not to disclose, right? The silencing that goes on. The consequences of trauma, where women disassociate from the experience and stand back. It's like they shut down, and we see this in victims of violence. So, you know, these are just very briefly. I'm not sure, but it might be too early to see whether this works. The Council of Europe Treaty on Violence Against Women and Domestic Violence, which is the latest regional treaty on violence against women that we now have. So there is the normative gap in international law where we don't have anything. The first treaty on violence against women specifically was in 1994 in the Inter-American Human Rights System. The African system has what's colloquially called the Maputo Protocol, which is a treaty on women's rights but has provisions on violence against women, including on women asylum seekers. And then now the Council of Europe Treaty has the most progressive, I mean, it's not perfect, but in terms of the regional human rights system, it has Article 60 on gender-based asylum claims, three main obligations of states, take necessary legislative and other measures to ensure that gender-based violence is recognized as a form of persecution. So in a way, pushing European countries that become members to this treaty to put that into their national level laws and policy systems. All persecution grounds, so all five, interpret them in a gender-sensitive way as opposed to marginalizing and ghettoizing women's experiences into just one, and amongst others to introduce support services, gender guidelines, gender-sensitive procedures, I suppose training, etc. And I don't know, I stand to be corrected, but I'm not sure what the arguments were when this Article 60 was put into the Council of Europe Treaty. but whether it was about recognizing that there's a normative gap in the European system, because in the European Convention on Human Rights, asylum is not addressed. You have two directives, which again I consider soft law, on the substantive and procedural aspects of refugee law. But international law does govern, of course, European countries. So, in conclusion, the multiplicity of forms of violence, the causes, the consequences, needs to be part of the holistic and intersectional approach in asylum processes. Asylum processes must be underpinned by norms of equality, non-discrimination, dignity, etc. And we have this, you know, whole international law framework. And how do we holistically use international law as opposed to over-reliance on just the 1951 Refugee Convention? The challenges of failure of states in terms of acting with due diligence in protecting against and preventing violence, where impunity is the norm, not accountability. Again, my broken record. And whether violence, and I think, you know, I did a whole report, a thematic report, on how violence against women precludes the exercise of all human rights and is a barrier to effective citizenship, right? And I don't mean citizenship in terms of passports and nationality, etc., but the broadest part, women exercising agency in their own lives, in whatever, whether it's a country of origin or the country of where they seek refuge. So how do we address the essential exercise of full, inclusive, and participatory citizenship? And so we need a gender-responsive asylum process, which you all know already. Thank you very much, and I look forward to questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Rashida, for a brilliant paper. I do have a question about accountability, but I'm going to leave that for a moment, because I know that we're quite